supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Montgomery County District Attorneys concluded their case against Bill Cosby today. WHYY's Laura Benshoff joins me to sum up their arguments and look ahead to his defense. Laura, the case got underway one Monday. What's stood out for you so far?
Well, for the prosecution, you know, they have a pretty simple road ahead of them. They need to show that Andrea Constant didn't consent to sexual contact with Bill Cosby after he gave her pills he said were herbal sometime in January 2004. And the way they did that, you know, really came through in a few moments. One big moment was just Andrea Constant's own testimony. We've heard a lot about her. We've heard her story, but we hadn't heard from her in her own words before. So I think that, you know, that was almost 2 days of testimony alone, and that really stood out. The other thing having to do with her testimony that stood out was her mother came. And her mother, Gianna Constant, gave probably the best testimony we've seen of the case so far. You know, she's an Italian woman who lives in rural Canada, who seems to have been her daughter's advocate for a really long time. And when she got on the stand, you know, she really kind of fought back at everything the defense was throwing at her. In a way that was really just emotionally strong and powerful. So those were kind of the emotional high points, I would say. And also the prosecution really made a big point of bringing in Cosby's own words. He was involved in a civil case with Andrea Constant about a year after the alleged assault, and he sat for a more than 1,000-page deposition. There's 1,000 pages of his words where her lawyers just got to interview him. And the prosecution sort of selectively picked up pieces of that, including places where he said, you know, I got Quaaludes from my doctor to give women I wanted to have sex with. And, you know, as bad as that all sounds for Cosby, today his spokesman, Andrew Wyatt, kind of said it was no big deal.
Well, look, I don't think it was damaging. I think the fact that deposition was read, it didn't say anything, but they were in a relationship. They were having a relationship that he didn't want his wife to know about. I don't think that was damaging. I think that really helped our side out a lot. And finally, people getting to hear the truth, though. And that was the purpose of this whole matter, for people to come hear the truth, not the sensationalism that you see in the news, and people to get out and really hear the facts of this case.
Laura, let's go on to other testimony today, a sexual assault expert and toxicologist.
That's right. The prosecutors brought in some experts to kind of go back, fight back point for point some of the things that the defense has been saying. So the defense says it was consensual, and they try to show that by saying, well, the two maintained contact after the alleged assault. Well, she worked at Temple. He was a trustee at Temple. That's sort of how the prosecutors face it. But they also brought in a woman named Veronique Valier. She's a psychologist who specializes in sexual assault, and she sort of gave pretty broad and vague expert testimony just around the myths that the public has about sexual assault, that when it's someone that you know, someone who's close to you, you may not report it right away. You may keep contacting them. You may try to retain a relationship with them. They also brought out a toxicologist to just talk about the effects of various drugs that have been talked about in connection to this case. You know, Cosby says he gave Constant Benadryl. So a toxicologist said Benadryl is used as a sleep aid. Cosby's been known to give Quaaludes to women, or has said that. They talked about Quaaludes as well. So just kind of bringing in more of that hard expert evidence today.
Looking ahead to next week, is it likely that Cosby will testify?
Well, you know, we don't know, but his spokesman, again, Andrew Wyatt, kind of kicked that door open today.
Well, a lot of things were previously said, but in a ball game, things have changed and players are taken out, and sometimes the star player plays and sometimes they don't. So we're just going to see how things go and get the flow of things.
That's right. So obviously non-committal, but it's possible. You know, a witness list was read at jury selection, and they talked about people like the former Montgomery County DA, Bruce Castor, who declined to press criminal charges against Cosby in 2005. Some of the people we've seen could be called back, law enforcement who originally investigated the case. We don't know, but we do know that the defense's strategy seems pretty clear. They've called Constant untruthful in that word repeatedly. And they say that they had a consensual and romantic relationship. So I think we can expect a lot more of that.
WHYY's Laura Benshoff reporting. Former FBI Director James Comey's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday dominates the news. Let's dive into his statements regarding interactions with President Donald Trump and Russian interference in the U.S. election with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Well, Frank, at this point, it's a he said, he said. Let's start with what were attitudes about Comey prior to his testimony yesterday.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it is early. We don't know what the impact's going to be of his testimony, but prior to his testimony, James Comey was not all that popular a person. A couple of different polls showed him basically breaking even, about as many favorables as unfavorable. One poll even had him higher unfavorables than favorables. That's Comey, mind you. We know Trump's unpopular. So coming into this testimony, neither of these two gentlemen, Trump and Comey, were shining knights as far as the average American is concerned.
Perhaps more unpopular, but who was considered more trustworthy?
Well, Comey had a slight edge in one poll I looked at. Washington Post, ABC News, just prior to the testimony, asked Americans about how much trust you have in what they're going to say about Trump and Comey. And Comey edged out Trump, but neither had any numbers to write home about. It was just 36% who were on the positive side, I'll trust Comey, and 21% on the positive side, I'll trust what Trump has to say on the issue. Both individuals had a majority of people who said they were inclined not to trust what they say. So that's where we were coming into the testimony. I would give Comey an edge, but certainly not an overwhelming edge.
Let's park Comey Trump aside. How about the broader issue of Russian interference in the presidential elections? Is that beyond dispute in the American mind?
I think so. I've looked at a variety of polls which have asked about that, and most of them say that Americans overwhelmingly are concerned about it. They think it's very important, the fact that the Russians were interfering or allegedly interfering, and it needs to be looked into. So everything that I see about public opinion on Russia in the election suggests that the public accepts that as a fait accompli and thinks it's very important.
Also, then, they think it's very important the work that former FBI Director Robert Mueller will be doing as special counsel appointed by the Justice Department.
That's right. Clearly, Americans are going to look to see what comes up with Mueller's report whenever it does come out. And as we've been talking about, I just don't think we know what the impact of this is going to be. It's Trump, of course, says that the testimony by Comey helped him, vindicated him in some ways. Many other interpreters say that it was devastating for Trump. Where the American public stands, we're going to have to wait and see where the dust settles. We know that Trump's approval rating now is coming in at about 37%, hadn't dropped a lot recently, and we'll see where that goes in the week ahead as well.
Frank, also yesterday, the House voted to roll back core aspects of the 2010 Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. Are Americans paying attention to the alternative they're putting up, the Financial Choice Act?
Probably not in specifics, but we do know that the American public has consistently felt, or at least tilted towards saying, there was too much involvement of government in our general life. Americans clearly are more likely to say there's too much regulation of business and industry than too little, and the banking industry is not held in high esteem by the American public at all. So if you look at all these numbers, you would suggest that the public probably would tilt towards saying maybe it would be good to pull back some on the regulation of the banking industry.
Though I'm looking at some of the aspects of the proposal, it would weaken the powers of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and eliminate the Labor Department's fiduciary rule, requiring brokers to act in the best interest of their clients. I can't imagine that would resonate with public regard.
Well, you may be right. We, of course, and I don't think that any pollsters have really gotten into the highly detailed specifics like you just enumerated there, but probably the American public would be in favor of some of those things, but they haven't been tested at that level, to my knowledge.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Only one bank faced criminal charges after the 2008 financial crisis. It's not a big one like J.P. Morgan Chase or Citibank. It's a small, family-owned bank in Chinatown in New York. As WHYY's Alan Yu reports, a new documentary out in Philadelphia next week tries to answer the question, why this bank?
Abacus Federal Savings Bank isn't like other banks.
We know from firsthand experience, customers like ours get summarily kicked out of larger institutions every couple years when the larger institutions decide that this type of customer is not profitable.
That's Jill Sung, the president and CEO of the bank. They serve primarily Chinese American immigrants, so their services are a little different. For instance, they still have a type of account called a passbook savings account. Deposits and withdrawals are stamped on a passbook, so you have to do your transactions with an actual person. Jill Sung says most large banks don't offer those accounts anymore.
We need to maintain that still because we have a large sector of our population who's still using those passbooks. We can't turn them back and say, well, you know, don't use those anymore.
In 2012, when the New York County District Attorney indicted the bank for mortgage fraud, the Sung family was confused. Not because of the fraud, they knew about that. Back in 2009, they found out one of their loan officers was lying on mortgage applications, but they had already fired him, done an internal investigation, and shared their findings with federal authorities. And of course, the mortgage crisis implicated many banks, so why go after this one? For one thing, Abacus is a small bank. But there's also this.
To us, it's pretty transparently clear that race bias against Asian Americans, Chinese Americans played a role. We saw it in the way they approached the case. We saw it in the way they approached their witnesses. We saw it in the way they approached our employees.
Jiu Sung points to one instance when the DA arrested some bank employees very publicly.
8 or 9 of our former employees who they decided to arrest was linked by chain together and forced to walk through a row of media cameras. Most of them in that chain were women, and at least 1 or 2 of them were grandmothers.
Her sister and bank director Vera Sung says this is a stark contrast to how suspects are normally treated.
People take painstaking measures to actually cover the handcuffs with a coat or folders or whatever, because once you see handcuffs on somebody, you automatically now think they're guilty.
In France, it's illegal for media outlets to show suspects in handcuffs before they're convicted. New York DA Cyrus Vance Jr. declined to comment, but in the movie, he says the public arrest was, quote, very unfortunate.
Those decisions can also have implications and create feelings that don't reflect the view of the office or my view.
A documentary about this case, Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, will be showing in Philadelphia for a week starting June 16th. It'll be in more theaters nationwide afterwards. Alan Yu, WHYY News.
Philadelphia this week announced the 8 recipients of its first Digital Literacy Alliance Awards. Let's learn more about the project with Andrew Buss, Innovation Director for Philadelphia's Technology Office. Andrew, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
What is meant by digital literacy?
Sure. So digital literacy, we define primarily around content. So the ability to access or have access to content, the ability to find it, the ability to analyze it and share it.
And I presume that ability depends on many variables in Philadelphia, geography, economic considerations as well.
Sure. So Philadelphia, not surprisingly, has a large poverty issue. We have a lot of neighborhoods that are very underserved, particularly in terms of broadband connectivity. So kind of the start of this work was really around the KeySpot program, which is a citywide network of public computing centers. The great thing about the Digital Literacy Alliance is that the goal is really to build on that existing infrastructure that we've been creating over the last number of years.
So specifically, how has this advanced from KeySpot?
Sure. The idea with the alliance is to be able to generate innovation in the digital literacy space. And I think we've never really had the money to do that until now with the Digital Literacy Alliance. We have that infrastructure, and now it's really thinking about how can we take the challenge of digital literacy to the next level.
And so what are some short-term avails toward that end?
Sure. So a couple interesting grant applications that we funded. One is around tablet-based instruction for seniors. If you look at some of the Pew data, we found recently that seniors are making quite a bit of progress in moving toward the internet and technology. And this particular grant proposed using tablets, which are kind of a nice intermediary device kind of between smartphones and the full PC setup. That was done by Generations Online, or will be done by Generations Online. Another interesting grant, I think, is actually a joint organizational effort. We funded both CMAC and United Communities, which are in Southeast Philadelphia, going to be opening a technology lab specifically serving really rather diverse populations in Southeast Philadelphia, largely Vietnamese.
Is it precise enough to know approximately what percent of people are or are not connected?
Depends on what numbers you use. The Pew study is a couple years old now, at least a couple years old. That number was right around 20% that do not have access to the internet, which sounds high, but it's probably a lot lower than we were at the start of the KeySpot program. The idea with the public computing centers, of course, is that you would get people to establish the habit in a comfortable setting, and then they would see the value of having a connection at home.
What are some of the obvious ways people are disenfranchised by not having ready access to the internet?
Sure. Well, I always describe it as really not being able to do many things that you need to do in life if you don't have a connection to the internet. I think, obviously, looking for a job is much more challenging. Getting a GED is much more challenging. City services become much more challenging, locating healthcare. So I think as society has generally moved toward this internet-based service model, it's going to be very difficult for people who have no access to the internet to really make it through their normal life processes.
And so with that, what of the notion whereby once upon a time everybody had free access to the U.S. postal system? Shouldn't now, in 2017, everybody have, by virtue of being a citizen, have the same access to internet?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. We've been talking about universal access for quite a while. I think the position of the alliance, which is really cross-institutional, so we have the big telecom providers in the group as well, is that it should still be a utility, but people should be able to afford that utility. I think there will always be challenges around affordability. The progress I see on that issue is that when we started the KeySpot program, there really were no low-cost internet options. Now we at least have Internet Essentials from Comcast. So I think we're gradually making progress in terms of what I think of as a straight access question that's tied to affordability. And now the question you start to think about, if people have access to it, are they able to use it? Can they process that content? Can they use it to do the things they need to use it for?
Andrew Buss, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Buss is Innovation Director for Philadelphia's Technology Office. New York playwright Lynn Nottage spent 2 years researching and talking to residents of Reading, PA, a city of almost 90,000. The result? Sweat, her Pulitzer Prize-winning play about displaced steel workers grappling with their futures. Come Sunday, Sweat will be up for 3 Tony Awards, and this summer there will be a new multimedia show about Reading residents. Keystone Crossroads' Annette John Hall reports.
Lynn Nottage says she chose Reading because it ranks as the poorest city of its size in the nation, according to the 2010 census. More than half of Reading's residents are Latino immigrants, and only 8% of residents have a bachelor's degree, below the national average of 28%. After writing Sweat, Nottage says she wanted to give back to the city that had given her so much. So she came up with this idea to build a performance installation at the Reading Railroad Franklin Street Station, an abandoned train station downtown.
We decided that we wanted to reanimate that space and fill it with the stories of the people from Reading. And one of the reasons that we wanted to do this is that we feel that a city that's fractured along economic and racial lines that has tremendous potential, but people aren't looking each other in the eye and really talking to each other.
Reading Film Commissioner Santo Marabella says he hopes the project will generate dialogue.
There's a lot of hopeful things that could happen. One thing, for example, the place that we're going has been abandoned for a number of years, and I think it's never been perceived that what else could it be? It's a railroad station. Well, after this installation, people will see how it could be reimagined and possibly repurposed.
The installation opens July 14th and combines live performances, film screenings, and storytelling. Annette John Hall, Keystone Crossroads.
A new, very large sculpture has just risen along Philadelphia's stretch of the Schuylkill River. It's a 40-foot-tall abstract piece made of bent laminated wood and chain-link fence. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that what it represents is anybody's guess.
The piece soars straight up at one end, 40 feet high, with a giant gold ring hinged on top, like you might find on a pocket watch or a door knocker. The back of it curves down to the ground. It's called Big Bling, and the head of the Philadelphia Association for Public Art, Penny Balkenbach, has gotten an earful.
Oh, we've heard lots of interpretations. Many people see it as being anthropomorphic in a way, looking like an elephant or an Egyptian cat whose back is arched. Some people think it looks like a roller coaster.
Balkenbach borrowed Big Bling from New York. The Madison Square Park Conservancy commissioned this piece from artist Martin Puryear, and it stood in downtown Manhattan for the better part of a year. Now, for 6 months, it will be on the banks of the Schuylkill River. Puryear has always been reluctant to explain his work. He would rather viewers rely on their own imaginations. He did say, however, that he conceived this piece in reaction to Manhattan's buildings, the Flatiron Building in particular, and the residents of the Big Apple.
The piece is really about urbanity. It's about how people behave and how they're structured in very dense urban situations. How they yearn, how they struggle, how they stratify themselves, how they build. It has a completely different meaning here where there's no enormous building surrounding it. This is very bucolic and park-like. It has a very different meaning here.
Big Bling will remain beside Kelly Drive until November. The piece will never be permanently installed anywhere. It's not designed to withstand the elements for long periods of time, but it can be disassembled, stored, and relocated with relative ease. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. At the controls this week, Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, and Diana Martinez. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Mussoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations. Our News Director, Eugene Son. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.